Welcome back to the Global Research News Hour, which comes to you from Montreal, Canada. This is Michel Chossadovsky, our website, www.globalresearch.ca. This is hour two of our program, which is focusing primarily on Iraq and the U.S.-led occupation in Iraq. Our next guest on this hour is a prominent writer and movie director who joins us from France. Hanna Al-Bayati is a French Iraqi who has been involved in the anti-war movement, has written extensively, and is very familiar on the situation on the ground. And she is joining us from central France, Auvergne, in the wine region. Welcome to the program, Hanna.
Thank you.
Yeah, we're delighted. Bonjour. our program is broadcast out of Texas, so we'll have to speak English. Hanna, you've been, you are more recently involved in the issue of Iraqi refugees, people who have been forced from their homeland, who have fled Iraq. How many people have actually left Iraq as a result of the U.S.-led occupation?
Well, basically, there are two kinds of displacement. There is more than 2 million refugees that are in neighboring countries, mainly Syria, Jordan, Egypt. But there is also internally displaced people that are more than 2.5 million. I think the latest figures are 2.8 million people inside.
2.8 million displaced people inside the country and 2 million people, which is all have left the country as almost 10% of the population.
Yeah, the refugees as a whole is about 20% of the population.
And the people killed is another possibly more than 1 million, according to, we discussed that earlier in the program.
From 2003, and we are not talking about the victims of the sanctions period.
Exactly, and the sanctions also—it's the impact on people's lives through the impact of poverty, the destruction of the public health care system, and so on. I presume that's also another factor.
Exactly.
Tell me a little bit about how this campaign to protect the rights of refugees, how has that been undertaken? I know that you're very active in this regard.
Well, basically, we face a real problem, and it's a regional problem and, of course, a human tragedy. But the Iraqis who are displaced do not benefit from any rights. They are being considered tourists by hosting countries and voluntary migrants by the Iraqi so-called government. So no one is protecting them, and they are not granted any rights or benefits. There is a few that have been helped by the UNHCR that is trying its best, I suppose, to help the most in need. But there is not a mechanism that is providing for welfare, for education, for health, etc., for these millions of people. So we proposed, as they are Iraqi citizens, we say that they have a right to their national revenues. So we proposed to have a UNSC resolution that would force the Iraqi state to allocate the proportional share of national revenues for these refugees to hosting countries or within the country through responsible agencies,
we'll have to go
maybe
to
the United Nations,
we'll have
maybe
to go to
the
commercial
Arab
break.
Whoever can take up the burden.
We'll be back after the break with Hanna Al-Bayati. Stay with us. Welcome back to the Global Research News Hour. This is Michel Trostadovsky. Our program is an initiative of the Center for Research on Globalization. Our guest joining us from France is Hanna Albayati, and we are discussing the situation in Iraq, focusing specifically on the plight of Iraqi refugees, displaced persons. There are at present some 2 million Iraqi citizens, family, children, men, women, and children who have fled Iraq and who are living in very precarious conditions in neighboring countries. Hanna, you described the United Nations High Commission for Refugees. I understand that they have accepted their mandate. Would you say that they are doing enough in this regard?
Well, they are asking for increased donations from the international community, which is not coming fast. I cannot blame the UNHCR itself for not doing its job. It's more the occupation is doing its best to silence the plight of these displaced. The Iraqi government is doing its best also to silence plight. The UNHCR, I met in each hosting country, the regional bureau offices, and they are completely overwhelmed by the immensity of the crisis and the silence that is surrounding this crisis. Also, the hosting countries are facing a lot of problems. If you take Syria, in Syria alone, there is 1.5 million Iraqis that arrived between 2003 and now, and they already have a fragile economy with high unemployment. They cannot absorb 1.5 million people, including children, to put into schools and universities, etc. They don't have the infrastructure, basically. So there needs to be a solution that is above the hosting country's decision to help or not to help. The only way, Iraq is a very rich country, the only way would be to claim the natural right of each Iraqi citizen to benefit from its national revenues. Because it's been now 4 years that the UNHCR is asking for increased donation, and the donations are not coming. So we are calling for a legal way to get what is in fact the right of every Iraqi citizen, so as to cope with this situation.
Does the United Nations High Commission for Refugees take on a political position with regard to the occupation, which is an illegal and criminal occupation and war? Because I think that's important. The UN generally has been rather sort of subdued in taking a position against the occupation.
It continues to not take a position. It continues. They are voicing that it is the biggest humanitarian crisis on the planet. They are making regular reports on the displacement, but they are not taking position on the causes of this displacement, which is, of course, the occupation.
And they're not asking the occupation forces to bear any kind of responsibility for the displaced people. I mean, if the occupation, which is led by U.S. and British forces, is responsible for massive dispossession and migration to neighboring countries, well, then those member states of the United Nations have a legal responsibility in relation to the crisis that they have created.
Of course, it doesn't surprise the Iraqis themselves. The experience of the Iraqi people with the United Nations is 15 years of economic sanctions, or 13 years of effective economic sanctions, and now a very shy response to this crisis, I think since 1948 there hasn't been such a population displacement. And we have to understand that these people have been forced to fled. It's not what the Iraqi government is saying, that they are voluntary migrants, is the biggest hypocrisy. They have been forced to fled at gunpoint, each of them, and they represent all Iraqi society. Every single component of Iraqi society at one stage of this occupation has been threatened by one militia or another that is cooperating with the occupation and has been pushed either outside or inside the country. The people who cannot go outside, the internally displaced people, are the people who don't have enough funds to reach foreign countries. It is not that they want to stay in Iraq. It's that they cannot afford to reach Syria or Jordan or Egypt. So they end up in camps within Iraq.
Sami, a large share of the refugees have gone to Syria, and some have gone to Jordan. Jordan is much more of a U.S. Proxy state, very much aligned with, and so is Egypt up to a point. How do you describe how would you compare, has Jordan helped the refugees coming in at a political level?
Basically, in Syria, and up to 18 months ago, Syria was very generous, had opened its door. The Iraqis didn't need a visa to reach Syria. So the border was open. And they could, put their children into school and they could attend university with the same right as the Syrian citizens. It became such a burden that the regime did impose some restrictions. In Jordan, most of the people who went to Jordan could afford it, and the system within Jordan is privatized. Most of the schools are privatized. Most of the hospitals are privatized. So it really depends on each family's financial situation. The problem is most of the people who left thought that it was very temporary, that the occupation will not last as long as it's lasting. So they thought they could cope 1-2 years with their assets. But the occupation is lasting and their assets are being depleted. So even within Jordan, where it was the most privileged Iraqi families who managed to go to Jordan, they are now facing very difficult financial situation. And the living standards in Jordan are very high.
But tell me, are they refugee camps in Syria and Jordan, or are the refugees simply blending into the existing local population?
Well, this is each one has a position on this aspect. The Iraqis, I suppose, have a collective consciousness of the plight of the Palestinian refugees and refuse to end up in the same difficulty and dead end that happened to the Palestinians, to whom we granted the unalienable right to return but are not allowed to return. So they are not organizing themselves as a community. It is very nuclearized. People are renting flats, living together into flats. There is no camps. The camps are within Iraq. Outside Iraq, whether in Syria or in Jordan, they are in the towns, but they are not, neither blending, neither being organized as a community.
So, I mean, what are the occupation forces doing when people move from one part of Iraq to another, or even when they leave the country and presumably they control the borders? What do they do? Do they let people go, or do they harass them? Do they kill them at the border? Is it a dangerous voyage to go from Baghdad to Damascus seeking to flee the plight of occupation?
Well, it depends on the period of time, but it's not the occupation that targets the people fleeing. It is a plan of the occupation to make the people flee. The people who fled to neighboring countries are the skilled professionals of Iraq, very educated, middle-class people, and these people were very much aware that the plans of the occupation were contrary to the interest of the Iraqi people, so they were very anti-occupation. So at one point, the occupation thought it was in its interest to get these people outside the country so that they cannot organize, that they cannot contest or protest or the occupation. But Iraq is dangerous everywhere because there is no state, there is no law and order. So on their way out, there are criminal gangs, there are sectarian militias that are supported by the occupation. So yes, they are being targeted by the occupation, but not directly by the foreign forces.
But I understand, and this has been documented, that Iraqi intellectuals and professionals have been the target of assassination, and that these have been sponsored by the occupation forces, but generally led through death squadrons. In other words, is it the policy of the occupation to more or less destroy the country's intellectual and professional fabric? We'll have to go, unfortunately, to a commercial break, and we'll be back with Hanna Albayati after the break on the Global Research News Hour. Stay with us. Welcome back to the Global Research News Hour. This is Michel Shostakovsky, our guest on the program, Hanna Albayati. We, just before the commercial break, we raised the issue of extrajudicial assassinations of intellectuals and professionals. Hanna, can you respond briefly to that issue? And how serious?
Sure. Well, it took. We can document it. We have seen the funding of special death squads who have hit lists with names. People are being killed on their way to work, etc. But this is a very well-studied plan. First, it was hidden under the name of de-basification. They put hundreds of thousands of people unemployed in the name that they were Baathists. And they created a whole situation of lawlessness, that there was no, they disbanded the army and the police. So they tried to hide these assassination campaigns within the general violence. But we can very easily document, you can see on the Brussels Tribunal website a special section on the assassination of academics and the professors, where it is the intended dismantlement of the Iraqi state, and anyone who is educated becomes a target, because they want to render Iraq forever dependent on foreign aid and expertise, in order to grab and plunder Iraqi resources. It started not only under occupation, even the sanctions period was an initial policy to get the brains, Iraqi brains, out of Iraq. Then upon arrival, they dismantled the state. Then they introduced death squads. And if you see the results, not only has there been assassinations, I think 75% of the health professionals have fled the country. A very large part of the teachers and the university professors have fled. The lawyers and the judges have fled. The journalists and the media professionals have fled. Anyone who could articulate a patriotic position against the occupation has been a target, and instead have been promoted very backward, feudal, warlords who are ready to sell the future of the nation for their own private interests. And this has been going on for the last 6 years. The problem that the Americans are facing now is that they cannot pretend that there is a state. There is not such a thing as a functioning state. So even the people who collaborated with them cannot pass the so-called reforms that they want to pass, like the oil law, like the division of the partition of Iraq, because they are being rejected by the entire population. One has to remember that before the occupation, more than 60% of the Iraqi population was employed by the state. It was not a question of being Ba'athist or not Ba'athist. It was a welfare state where the majority of the population were civil servants. These people have been put unemployed and replaced by very backward, uneducated, exiled Iraqis who can be bought, who can be subdued, who can be subjugated, but who cannot even achieve the goals of the American occupation.
Hannah, this is a slightly different topic, but I think it's very much related. I recall that when we met that was more than a year ago in Kuala Lumpur, and your presentation also to this major event which was organized by the former Prime Minister of Malaysia, Tun Mahathir Mohamad, that you criticized the anti-war movement for not recognizing, in a sense, the resistance, the Iraqi resistance. How do you view the anti-war movement in Europe and in the United States? Does it recognize the
realities? Well, I think it is very weak in position. Maybe it is coming to terms with some difficulties now, thanks to the Iraqi resistance, because now the situation is clear. It is clear that the Americans never came with genuine proposal. It is clear that the Iraqi people in its entirety is rejecting the occupation. Maybe the Iraqi people uses different means. Some are using armed struggles, some are using political resistance, some are using civil resistance, but the whole population is against the occupation. The anti-war movement took some time and made some mistake into using the terminology of the occupation. I will give you an example. They took a lot of time to call the Iraqi rejection of the occupation a resistance. They called it an insurgency for a long period of time. But this is a problem of concept. An insurgency is a riot against a legal government. There is no legal government in Iraq. There is an installed government by an occupation that is rejected by the population.
To go to another commercial break, unfortunately. Sorry for interrupting you. We'll be back after the break with our guest, distinguished...
You're listening to the Republic Broadcasting Network. Because you can handle the truth.
Cascadia Public Radio. Welcome back to the Global Research News Hour. This is Michel Chostadovsky. The program is an initiative of the Center for Research on Globalization, our website, www.globalresearch.ca, which contains an extensive coverage from the Middle East and around the world on issues which are barely covered by the mainstream media, with feature contributions by several prominent writers. Our guest, Hannah Al-Bayati, joins us from France. She has been active in the in relation to Iraq for many years, and she is currently involved in the campaign to protect the rights of Iraqi refugees, people who have fled their homeland for neighboring countries. Welcome back, Hanna. We were discussing the issue of the anti-war movement just before the break. Yeah, go ahead.
I think the anti-war movement has a great opportunity now. I think it's possible with the American elections coming up. There is momentum for discussing the terms of withdrawal of the U.S. occupation. The Americans want to withdraw. This is accepted by all, even by the collaborators of the Americans in Iraq, who fear the withdrawal. It is possible now for the anti-war movement to play a prominent role in supporting and echoing the voice of the Iraqi people on how they hope to be really sovereign and not a half withdrawal. And for this, one has to recognize the continuous struggle of the Iraqi people and the clarity of their position. The problem is that the American imperialism creates a lot of confusion, and within the anti-war movement there is confusion. For example, supporting the Iraqi resistance, some people think that it means that we would be rather keen to let the Americans attack Iran for the role Iran played in Iraq in the last few years, which is not true. There is a possible position that is in the interest of all people, the American people, the Iraqi people, the neighboring countries of Iraq, which we could voice a real position that is protecting the sovereignty of each nation without interference in their internal affairs and the sovereignty over their national resources. The Iraqis, for example, even if they criticize the role that Iran played inside Iraq in cooperation with the American occupation, they do not wish that Iraq be a helpful hand into attacking Iran. They don't want what happened to them to happen to the Iranian people. They are just saying, we refuse interference from neighboring countries. We refuse occupation. We want total sovereignty over our natural resources. We have proved for the last decades that we are able to exploit, administer our national resources for the benefit of the majority of our citizens. The anti-war movement has the opportunity now to take a very clear position. I hope it makes it.
Well, I certainly hope it will. But if you look at what's happening in the U.S. presidential election campaign, Obama has a slightly different position to that of McCain, but it's not entirely clear where he stands with regard even to the withdrawal of U.S. troops from Iraq. How do you view the American position in the light of these elections?
Well, sure, I don't consider Obama anti-war, but I hope with enough pressure and a voice in unity from all the groups that exist worldwide in what is called the anti-war movement, but that derives also from the anti-globalization movement, that we can apply enough pressure, because it is not in the interest of the American people to continue this policy. It is not only about the Iraqi people, Iraq is destroyed, the Iraqi middle class has been decimated. It is obvious for any Iraqi that this whole past 6 years is a disaster. But we have to articulate well enough to make the American people themselves understand, even the people who support Obama and who have hope that Obama might change the course, which I doubt, but to put enough pressure to show that this adventurous military imperialism that tries to plunder other people's resources end up in a disaster. It's very bad for the American people. Their economy is being damaged. Their image is completely desecrated outside the United States. If you take before the invasion of Iraq and now, the reputation of the American or the United States is very damaged. The people know about the massive violation of human rights that are being done in the name of so-called democracy. People know that even the American army itself is being destroyed by the privatization of the military. We have to be able to make people understand that it only benefits a few private companies and a little elite wherever in the United States, tomorrow in China, after tomorrow in Russia or in France, but generally the people share the same interest, let be they American, Iraqi, Iranian, Zimbabwean. This is, I hope the goal, if we discuss enough ahead of these elections, that we can come to a common position on what would be a just peace, what would be acceptable international relations. And if you look at the failure, for example, of the Doha rounds, you understand that even small countries know that the privatization of their national resources is against their interest. So they will not bend their heads. This is a very big achievement. We have to make more clear what unites everybody, every single people, with its local culture, its local customs, against this neoliberal agenda of plundering people's resources.
I hope that this message that you are conveying will spread across the United States. This program is broadcast out of Houston, Texas. It reaches a number of stations across America. It's rebroadcast by satellite and internet radio. I think that what you've described is very much shared by U.S. public opinion in at least the gut feeling that people are against this war, but perhaps what we don't have in North America, United States and Canada, is the political mechanisms, the networking to ultimately undermine the military agenda from within the United States. But the message that you've given, which I think reflects also the view of many people around the world and certainly in the Middle East, is very important. And it's an optimistic perspective that ultimately we can defeat the forces of war. Let me ask just a question, which is somewhat related and unrelated. The Bush administration, when they launched the war in 2003, they used the pretext of weapons of mass destruction. We then found out, of course, that was a fabrication. And in other words, the whole rationale for waging this war, which was so-called regime change and weapons of mass destruction, has since then emerged that this was a fabrication and a falsehood, and so it's the question of legitimacy. How do you view the legitimacy of this war?
Well, you know, with more than 1.5 million people murdered, 5 million refugees, if you take any Iraqi, even an Iraqi who was very deeply opposed to the former regime, no one can say that we benefited or that there was any legitimacy for the American intervention in Iraq. And it is not only about the consequences. If you take back in 2003, most of the people who are a little politicized were very aware of the American plans, even if they didn't know that there were no weapons of mass destruction, etc. They were very conscious that if we are talking about human rights, if we are talking about regime change in the name of democracy for the benefit of the local people, then why did the...
Hello? Hello? Yeah. It seems that we have had some small technical problem with the telephone line again with France this time. Earlier it was with Great Britain. RBN has ensured me that Hanna Albayati will be back on with us within the next few minutes. Hanna, are you there? It seems that, again, the line has been cut. Essentially, to summarize Hannah's position, I think a very forceful and optimistic message to people around the world. Hannah, welcome back. We're having telephone problems today.
That's fine.
Yeah, just maybe to shift slightly the subject, because you're in France at the moment, your father is Iraqi, your mother is French, you were brought up in France, and now there's also regime change in France with a new president, Nicolas Sarkozy, who has been somewhat pro-American, is he not?
He is, and he's also very self-centered. I have to admit that I'm not surprised that the French people elected Sarkozy, like I'm not surprised that the Italian people re-elected Mussolini. I'm sorry.
Berlusconi. Yes.
This is a general atmosphere. Europe is not taking position. Russia is not taking position. China is not taking position. Everybody is waiting for the American empire to collapse to see what role and how they can benefit from this collapse. And the international community has not taken the opportunity to step in and leave the vacuum of in the opinion. I find, for example, in France, the intellectual class extremely poor and extremely salty the power, including the left. I am sorry to make such a non-optimistic concept, but this is the case. It's sad because we are, if you take the developing world, the majority of the people of this planet are actually realizing their potential. If you take Latin America, if you take including the Arab world, people are conscious that now they have skills, they have possibilities, they can defend their interests even against the local dictatorships that are being supported by the Americans or the French or the British. We hope that these voices who defend the majority of the world would be echoed by the European or the American middle class. But until now, the European and the American middle class is looking at its own belly button and trying to protect the few benefits that they gained with the welfare state. It is unfortunate because, in fact, the wild neoliberalization that is being defended by the Bush administration or by Nicolas Sarkozy will... is against this middle class and wants to dismantle this middle class.
But if you go back a few years to the months leading up to the Iraq War. I'm talking about March 2003. We had a very significant anti-war movement throughout Western Europe and certainly in France. There were lots of people mobilized, and also the French government at the time was quite opposed to the U.S.-led invasion, as was Germany. But the situation now has been totally reversed with a new government and new people in office. Is that not... How do you view that situation?
I think that the majority of the people are still very much opposed to the war and to the occupation, the people themselves. Then there is, and this is worldwide, a weakness of analysis. People fall into this propaganda of the clash of civilization, even if they don't admit it. In France, for example, there is a very strong idea that laicity is the most important concept to defend, and when they are being fed every single day by mainstream media that the Iraqi resistance is Islamist, then they feel very uncomfortable to support the resistance, so they don't have a clear position. So we cannot say that they are very clearly anti-occupation. What we have to do, and you do it with your website and all the work that you do, is to dismantle the propaganda. Who has promoted the Islamists in Afghanistan and in Iraq is the United States. Who are these so-called Al-Qaeda? Nobody has made any investigation on who is behind every attack.
And I will have to go to a break again. I'm unfortunately a commercial break, and then we'll conclude. Our guest, Hannah Albayati, stay with us. We'll be back after the break. Welcome back to the Global Research News Hour, which is an initiative of the Center for Research on Globalization. My name is Michel Chosadovsky. Our guest on the program is distinguished author and filmmaker Hannah Albayati, who has been actively involved in the anti-war campaign against occupation forces, and who joins us from France. We have about three more minutes to the end of this program. Hannah has sent us a very powerful message. Can you give us some very pointed, a very pointed message for this last slot of our program?
Let's say that if there was a purpose about this war and occupation, this purpose has failed. So every day that we extend this war and occupation is an absurd day of war and occupation. Every single goal of the Bush administration is non-achievable. Even the people who are collaborating with the Bush administration or the U.S. occupation for the past 6 years know this and cannot pass the legislation that the Bush administration is hoping to pass. It became killing for killing. I am saying the Iraqi people are extending their hand to the world. They want peace. They know that it's not in the interest of the American people to continue this occupation, and there is a way out if we do respect the sovereignty of the nations over their lands, their future, and their resources. And there is no such a thing as clash of civilization in the world. There is only a clash between powerful elites who are trying to rob the entire planet and the rest of the people of this planet, who have all interest in communicating with each other, exchanging and discussing their different cultural views in the world. This is richness. It is not a barrier between the people. On the contrary.
and the resistance is a secular resistance, and Iraq is a secular society fundamentally.
Iraq has always been secular. The regime that the U.S. occupation put in power is an Islamist regime. Iraq was always secular. We can say that the former regime was non-democratic, but we cannot say that it was Islamist.
And so in essentially you're saying that Islamism, the greatest promoter of Islamism in the world today is the United States foreign policy and its intelligence and military apparatus.
And funding.
How much does this war cost on a daily basis to the American taxpayer?
$720 million a day.
How much does it cost per minute?
I think $500,000.
Right. $500,000 per minute. Please take note, because that is an encroachment also on all areas of social expenditure in the United States, which are being diverted to supporting the military and their contractors and their profit-driven agenda.
Exactly.
Where are you going next in terms of your campaign, just in 20 seconds?
I think we are organizing a meeting in my house, where I'm staying now in France, where we will try to reach a consensus with several people, including American people and Europeans and Iraqis, to try to draft a peace proposal, and we hope to publicize it quickly.
Thank you very much. Hanna El-Bayati, join us next week on the Global Research News Hour, which will be hosted by Stephen Lenman.